So you want to look at some Commandy now?
I guess so. Move into the world of dystopia.
Hello.
Oh, wait, that's not what. Sorry, it was the newspaper I picked up.
That's just as dystopian.
I picked the wrong thing up.
Well, whether it be our dystopian world or the imaginary Jack Kirby dystopian world, we're going to look at some Commandy now.
This whole city used to be filled with humans. Families, brothers, fathers. My grandfather worked for a secret organization. When the disaster struck, he sealed us in a protected chamber called Command D. And, yeah, that's how I got my name. He and I were the last survivors. We stretched the supplies as long as we could. We had a few books, some info reels. He taught me all he could. Until... he was my only companion. My only friend. His final words were, "You were the last boy on Earth, Commandy. For the sake of humanity, you must survive."
If we're going where I think we are, I doubt any of us will survive.
Journey with them now. Back to the bins.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am here with my very good buddy, Mr. David Pascarella.
How's it going?
I'm doing all right, except for my grilling woes, which we just discussed and may or may not make it into the episode. But otherwise, all is good, and, you know, how wrong can you go when we get to sit and talk funny books for an hour or so?
It doesn't get any better than that. Well, maybe it does get better than that, but...
That's the old Dennis Miller line. He's, you know, they remember the beer Löwenbräu? And they used to have the commercials, and they'd say, "It doesn't get any better than this." And in his comedy routine, he was, or, you know, stand-up routine, he was saying, "You know what? If it doesn't get any better than this, I'm just taking a gun and stick it in my mouth, because this isn't so freaking great." But you know what? It doesn't get a lot better than this. I enjoy the heck out of doing this. That's why I've been doing this for... low these 12 and a half years now.
Established 2012.
I don't know how tired people are of listening to me, but I'm still enjoying doing it. And each time we come up with a new project, I kind of get a kick out of it. We're doing the Commandy project. Bill and I got the Avengers stuff going. You and Scott have the Origins. We all have Legends. I'm just starting on one with Gene Hendricks, where we're going to be doing Camelot 2000, Camelot 3000, Camelot some thousand, whatever it is. So I've talked about doing Dracula books with Trentus Magnus, but so far we just haven't been able to line that up. But that could be fun too. And then we stick in the random books periodically, along with the occasional Freaky Five list. It's a lot of fun to be had.
Yeah, I'm curious to listen to the Camelot 3000 ones. I've never even looked at one of those books.
Well, I would recommend it. I've enjoyed it, and Gene brought issue one to an episode, and it was not as by chance as our War is Hell issue episode, but... But I actually looked for it. I did a quick Google search for King Arthur in comic books, and I found an issue of World's Finest where Batman and Superman go back to King Arthur's court and have an adventure. So we did the two issues, you know, the World's Finest and the Camelot 3000 episode, and then we decided while we were doing it that we're going to do the other 11 issues of Camelot 3000.
Oh, so it only ran 12.
Yeah, it was a maxi series, they would call it.
Oh, okay.
And it was an interesting run too, because it went 11 issues, and then there was a year that they took off for reasons I don't know, and then the 12th issue came out.
Then you had to review everything and just get back up to speed.
Yeah, well, I also have the trade on it and stuff, so I've enjoyed this one, so I'm looking forward to redoing it.
There's an Elseworld. I know I haven't gotten to it yet. It's called Cal, where it's Superman and like King Arthur's time. I have been reading a variety of stuff lately, you know, old completed series, which I'm really enjoying the hell out of it.
I haven't been reading that much lately just because I just haven't found the free time lately.
I've gone outside, you know, my comfort zone, and I'm reading three different series. One is called Why the Last Man.
That's excellent. That I've read.
That one I think I'm liking the best. DMZ.
That I never read.
What the hell is the third one? Ex Machina.
That I started to read and got sidetracked. Why the Last Man is a very fast read.
Yeah, I only started very recently. I'm up to issue like 7, I think.
Yeah, it's as far as the time it takes to read each issue, I would liken it to the Walking Dead books. Each issue is probably, you know, like a 5 to 7 minute read. And each one ends on some kind of a cliffhanger.
My Golden Age reading project has slowed down because it takes you so long to get through. You know what I'm saying?
I find that really amusing because the comics then were so much more geared towards young kids. And yet us old folks take so much longer to read them than they do the ones that were actually written for us.
But yeah, I guess you figured they're so text heavy back then. You know what I mean? And the books were so much bigger. I've already cut out. I'm only reading the characters, you know, that were related to the Justice Society. I don't have time anymore for reading, like, The Whip and that kind of stuff.
Well, as you're reading those, if you come up with issues where you think, you know what, this one really does have some sort of connection to the more modern-day stuff, we should probably think about covering them just because we're doing the Legends books anyway.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I read recently the first appearance of Two-Face. It's from 42, late 42. And it was a two-part story. It's the first two-parter I've ever come across. And there was a month in between.
Right.
And they tell you at the end, okay, continued, not next month, the month after. It'll be continued.
Oh, wow.
And there, you know, what
I think that was unheard of back then.
What was amusing, too, is, you know, his name is originally Harvey Kent instead of Harvey Dent.
I did not know that.
And when he gets scarred, Bruce Wayne's telling him, you know, oh, there's this fantastic plastic surgeon. He can fix this, but he's a prisoner of the Nazis. So, you know, gotta wait. But the doctor's name is something like Dr. Eckhart. And I found it hysterical that the actor who plays him in The Dark Knight Rises has the same last name.
Wasn't that the name of the dirty cop in Batman 89?
Is it? Yeah, Eckhart. Was it Dan Aaron Eckhart play him in the...
I think so. I think that name is littered through a Batman history, apparently.
I mean, it's funny, you know, you could plan to make the dirty cop have the same name if you were that, you know, into Easter eggs, but the odds of an actor with the same last name having a connection.
Yeah, no, it's pretty wild. Well,
that
you
might
know,
be something to cover.
Is it any more? Yeah, that might be. I think that could be fun. Is that any more wild than George Reeves and Christopher Reeve?
Right, you couldn't plan it.
So, it's interesting stuff. But yeah, maybe if you point out those issues to me and I can find them to read them, maybe we'll cover those one episode.
Yeah, I will, to you.
Okay. In the meanwhile, I guess the first book we have is Commandy number 6, which is weird because I had read this. Obviously, you know, we kind of got delayed in recording this. And I'd read it a while ago, along with issue 7. Those are the two we're covering today. And I only prepared my synopsis of issue 7 today.
But that's all right. I did 6 last night.
But I also reread 6 just, you know, so that I can have it more familiar in my brain so we could talk about it. And as I was reading it, I'm thinking certain thoughts, and I'm thinking, didn't we already have this discussion? And I guess it's that I'm just having the same kind of mental processes that I had the first time, and somewhere in my mind I've created a Mandela effect that you and I had a chance to discuss it.
Yeah, so, we definitely have not discussed this yet.
Yeah, originally, just for what it's worth for everybody listening, is issue number 7 has a King Kong vibe to it. There's no real spoiler there. And since Scott is our resident King Kong expert, I was hoping to get him on the episode when we covered it. But unfortunately, things have gotten in the way. Life has gotten in the way, and Scott can't be here tonight. And so we finally decided, well, we're going to just go ahead and record this. But he is missed for not being able to be here. But, you know, he did have, for what it's worth, a legitimate reason to not be here. And
he's always putting his family first.
I know, family, job, all this stupid shit. But whatever the case may be, Scott is unable to join us. So if he wants to give us some thoughts in the future, he's certainly going to be welcome to. But in the meanwhile, Commandee number 6. Take it, Dave.
All right. Commandee, the last boy on Earth, number 6. Cover dated June of 1973. On sale March 13th of 73 for a whopping 2 dimes, 20 cents. Written and penciled by Jack Kirby, inked by Mike W. Arroyo. Chapter 1, Flower. Commandee and Flower, the topless girl with the flower in her hair, race across the desert in a dune wagon. From the cockpit of the dune wagon, which is a combination dune buggy and covered wagon, Flower and Commandee hear the buzzing of motors. I've never quite heard a motor buzz, but okay. Suddenly, they are intercepted by uniformed riders on dune cycles. I think you can see a theme in the naming practices in this world. The helmeted riders are shocked to see 2 animals driving a vehicle. The leader orders the riders to stop the humans before they kill themselves. Commandee sees the trap and opens fire, taking out one of the riders by blasting his tire. Before he can score again, Commandee is knocked out by a truncheon to the head. The rider finds both Commandee and Flower knocked out and hopes they are okay because they are unusually fine specimens of wildlife. The riders are lions, who are conservationists seeking to preserve endangered species, including man. Sultan, their leader, orders Commandee and Flower to be taken with their supplies to the wildlife sanctuary. Chapter 2, Commandee, Last Boy on Earth. Bit redundant, if you ask me. The sanctuary is a place of protection for wildlife that thrives in its guarded boundaries. Once it was an exclusive green area for upper middle class homeowners. Now as dawn breaks across the Nevada skies, Commandee and Flower awaken there in the dune wagon with all their effects, minus Commandee's rifle. Quickly, Commandee finds himself under attack by primitive humans, right out of Planet of the Apes. Commandee makes short work of the non-speaking primitive screwheads. Further exploration leads Commandee and Flower to the remains of a formerly exclusive housing development. Chapter 3, People Hunters. As Commandee and Flower explore, sinister figures watch from the shadows. Puma poachers. Say that 3 times fast. The pumas disdain for the liberal lions and believe they are the preordained masters of North America. As the greedy pumas watch, the previously defeated humans return, seeking, as Flower predicted, Commandy's leadership. The Pumas attack, and Commandy engages them. Flower jumps into the fray, protecting Commandy, and is thrown aside. Taking advantage of the distraction, Commandy seizes a gun and sends the Pumas scattering. The melee has not gone unnoticed. The lions watch, and Sultan is somewhat impressed. Chapter 4, Death. As night falls, Commandy and Flower set up house in one of the suburban relics. Amazingly, even though the house is a wreck, the lights and stove work, and the kitchen is fully stocked. After Flower falls asleep, Commandy realizes that they are in a zoo. But who are the keepers? While Commandy is lost in thought, Flower is attacked by the Puma poachers. A shout brings Commandy running, and a standoff results. Flower makes a sudden move and is shot in the back. Before the poachers can kill Commandy as well, the lions arrive and place the Pumas under arrest. Regretfully, the lions are unable to help with Flower, and they regret that they could not have gotten there sooner. As Flower dies, Sultan and his deputy recognize the intelligence of this particular animal and feel pity for him. So remember, as Charlton Heston would say, guns don't kill people. Pumas with guns kill people.
True words were never spoken.
So what did you think of this?
The first thing that jumps out at me is I'm wondering how Kirby kind of decided to put together the factions. Because, so far, it's pretty much, every animal breed for itself. They're tight groups. You got tight groups of tigers, tight groups of gorillas, tight groups of pumas now. There were tight groups of rats before. But there doesn't seem to be any sort of mix between them. And I'm thinking at some point we're going to see one that's going to betray its own breed and kind of help the other side or something. But it would be interesting to see how they do that. I'm curious like how he came up with pumas to be the bad guys in this.
Well, I could see how the lions are like the noble whatever, yeah. but I don't, yeah, I'm with you. I don't see what made pumas stand out.
He's clearly made the lions as the noble group so far. I thought it was interesting. I think, we talk about frequently about the modern way of storytelling as opposed to what they did 40 and 50 years ago. And I think if this was now, Flower would have been around a little bit longer to give us more of a chance to get to know her and more of a chance to have her and Commandy build up a little bit of a relationship so that when she died, it would just have a little bit more gravitas to it. I find it amusing that there's so many humans that can speak, and then everybody's always so surprised when one of them does. Mm-hmm. I don't really get that. I did like, I guess it does kind of go with my one breed going against itself. I kind of like the fact that the primitive humans, were ready to challenge Commandy and kind of try and take him out. But as soon as he defeated their leader, he became the leader. So, there's still something there. The artwork looks a little different in this one to me. And I don't mean it in a negative way. I think it's just different, not necessarily better, not necessarily worse, but the line work looks a little bit less detailed in a lot of spots. And then there's some where the faces don't look Kirby-like to me. In particular, page 8 of the story, there's a close-up, the second panel, there's a close-up of Commandy's face. That just doesn't look like him to me.
You mean the derp face?
Yeah, he's got a derp face on. I thought it was interesting. One of the things, remember I said I kind of had the Mandela effect of discussing with you? And that's the scene, the first page, the splash for Chapter 4, Death, with the fire burning. I like the fact that there's the heavy shadowing that a fire would create on one side. I don't know that it's kind of accurate as far as what is getting lit up by the fire and what isn't, because Commandy's right side probably should be much more enveloped in the dark, because that's the side that's away from the fire. But just the same, I kind of like the heavy line work there. Also, a little bit of a derp face at the bottom of page, what is it, 18?
What, the one on the left?
Yeah.
He looks like Oliver there asking, may I have some more, please?
Yeah, that could be. Yeah, like I said, the whole thing with the Pumas is interesting, how they are the poachers. And then, you know, the reaction when Flower is killed, you know, Commandy obviously takes it very hard. And again, I think that would have been better served if she had been around for another issue or two, just to develop her character a little bit more and his kind of depending on her. Maybe have her teach him something at some point, you know, instead of just becoming the girl in distress, which is kind of what she is here. I like the fact that the leader of the Lions recognizes Commandy's intelligence and respects it. So overall, you know, good story.
I did not think they were going to take Flower out that quickly. And I think that was actually, like you implied, a bit of a mistake.
Yeah, I think so.
I do find the whole design of Flower quite interesting, with the topless with her hair managing to hang in the proper locations all the time. Particularly when we have seen other folks covered up, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, you know, it was an interesting choice to have her be uncovered, but just the same to make it so that the Comics Code Authority isn't going to give you a hard time. Not only does the hair strategically cover her breasts, but she doesn't even have any kind of indication that there are breasts underneath there. There's no kind of curve to it or anything. So I find it kind of amusing, but creative in its own way.
Today would have been a mature audience comic, and there would be nothing left to the imagination.
Yes, probably not.
I feel the art took a bit of a dip in this one, generally speaking. I didn't quite enjoy it as much as previous issues.
No, I thought it was good. Like I said, I didn't know that it was better or worse. I did sense that it was different, so I guess your mileage could vary on that. It does look like I said, it looks a little less detailed. I'm thinking Royer might have been a little rushed on this because the backgrounds don't look as detailed as you normally get from a Kirby book. I mean, you have some that are very ornate, like the splash page for Chapter 2, which is, you know, a scenery shot. But other than that, you know, a lot of the backgrounds are kind of simple and not really very detailed, which is not really a Kirby trait. His detail is a Kirby trait, so the lack of detail would be mildly surprising. But still not bad. I even like, you know, the shot I was saying with the fire, like the detail, like there's layers to this house. The door is open and then inside you could see the staircase and the cracked mirror. So, I mean, there definitely is some detail work going on. The derp faces take away from it.
The Lions really seem like the most advanced society that we've met so far.
Yeah, and I think we're going to see a step towards that again in the next issue.
I mean, particularly for me, the whole when they burst in, you know, they don't just kill them, the Pumas. You're under arrest.
Yeah.
I'm curious. They must have a whole judicial system.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me. And again, we'll get into that a little bit more in the next issue. But you know, their society seems to be more based on our society than anyone else that we've seen so far.
Yeah. On the page 17, the chapter 4 splash page, I liked the shadowing, even though it's not, you know, probably as it should look, because it's, for me, it's the foreshadowing of what's coming, that a darkness is coming over the storm. Mm.
Yeah. And you know, if you want to kind of take it a little further, when you stand by a fire, like if you're at a bonfire with somebody and you're talking to them, as the fire ebbs and wanes, and gets blown a little in the wind, the shadows kind of shift on the person you're talking to. So I do think this has the feel of that. I think if you had Commandy back, maybe like 4 steps further mm-hmm. back, so that the fire was kind of in front of him a little bit more, then that would make more sense from that perspective. But the way they show him, it's as if the fire is slightly behind him, which would mean you wouldn't be getting that flickering on his face, which is the way it's kind of drawn.
Right.
At least that's the perspective that I'm getting on it.
So I guess we should assume the poachers, the Pumas, are going to sell them for slaves?
I think that's the...
Right?
That's the intent. Or you know, to be more disgusting, use them for food.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's what I was, you know, curious about.
I mean, I can't think of any other purpose that the poachers would have for it, because... But, like, poachers in our real life, you think about poachers, they're killing, basically they're killing animals they shouldn't kill, usually, like, you know, for tusks or for whales and stuff. Yeah, I mean, trophies and food and keepsakes, not so much, although I guess, you know, if we consider the entire world and things, I mean, I'm sure there's poachers for slaves as well. So, could be any of the above, I guess.
Well, should we rate this baby?
Oh, I think we can.
All right, well, I'm going to start with the cover. The cover is very busy. It doesn't quite represent anything that's in the book. Because looking at the cover, you would assume that the lions are taking them prisoner for whatever nefarious purpose. And I guess it's a good misdirect, because when you get to the story, that's really completely the opposite. The figures of Commandy and Flower are a bit, I don't know, they seem a bit off to me. The lions look good. There's something about the black and yellow that does pop for me that I think is rather decent. And it's a detailed background, though not in color. It's a good cover, but it's not a great cover. I think it's just slightly above average. And I would rate this cover with a... I'd give it a B-. The story? I found the story itself good. It's an interesting concept where, you know, you're seeing, I see the lions as a representation of, I'm going to sound jingoistic, of America of the past. You know, the idealists out to save the world in their own way. And it's an interesting concept applied to, you know, the lions. I like the idea of the wildlife preserve, and it does kind of harken back to, you know, the concept in Planet of the Apes, where, you know, putting people in the zoo as well. So it was an interesting story. I was sad to see Flower depart. I really like the Lions. The Pumas, there's nothing redeeming about them. And as we've already said, I don't want to beat a dead horse. I'd like to find out, you know, what made him rate certain animals in certain hierarchies. Like, I could see rats being bad. Pumas, I'm more curious. So overall, I gave the story a solid B+. The interior art, as I said, I think it takes a slight dip. And I went with the C. So overall, I would grade this a B-.
All right, that's fair. So on the cover, I think the layout of the cover is very strong. I've mentioned before my distaste for the only making the cover 2/3 of the picture and having mm-hmm. the logo be a third. And we have that here. But one of the things that Kirby does that I like is the two lions on the sides, he has their heads extend beyond that break point and still kind of be on the cover. I also like the fact that the lions are on each side. It's reminiscent to me of kind of like the stairs going up to the library or whatever with the lion statues. I like that the background, all the lions in the background are a different color. It helps to make Commandy and Flower pop out a little bit more and give them more of a three-dimensional feel. But I also agree with you that the detail work on Commandy and Flower seems... Actually, not so much Flower, more Commandy. The detail work just doesn't seem quite right to me. Especially his face looks very un-Kirby-esque to me. Mm-hmm. And I think I agree with your assessment. This is a good cover, not a great cover. And I'm going to say overall it's a B. It's good. It just, you know, it could be even better. The interior art, I'm a little higher on it than you are. But I do see what you're saying, and there's a few derp faces in here that I don't like. But there's also a couple of shots that I like a lot. So I'm going to say a B- on the interior art. I think there's room for improvement, but it's still... The layouts are still strong. The storytelling is good, and most of the scenes I'm enjoying. The story itself suffers some from feeling a little rushed. I would have liked to have seen this one slowed down, like I said so many times already, about, you know, just to let us know Flower a little better before you take her from us, and we'll feel the loss even more. But I also like the way he's setting the lions up as the more noble beasts. And you know, speaking of Planet of the Apes, there's almost a feel like in Planet of the Apes, in the original five more so than later, you have a very clear class distinction between the gorillas being the warmongers, the chimpanzees being the scientific community, the orangutans kind of being the political people. So, you know, there's the breakdown of that. So I'm thinking Kirby is doing a little bit of that with the different breed of animals, you know, with the lions and the bears and I don't think we've seen any bears yet. The lions and the gorillas and the pumas and everything. So, you know, they all have their own distinct way of doing things. And I kind of like that the lions are the noble beasts so far. Again, you know, my biggest complaint is just that they did away with Flower too quickly, but I think that was kind of the way of storytelling at the time, so I don't want to hit it too hard on that. So I'm going to give the story a solid B as well, and I'm going to give the book a B. I enjoyed reading it.
Yeah, within the same ballpark.
So that brings us over to Commandy number 7. And in Commandy number 7, it is cover dated July of 1973. The cover shows Commandy in a prone position on a ledge with a giant hand with very strange fingernails reaching down for him. In the background, there are two biplanes approaching from a distance. Now, I was looking at the fingernails just for whatever reason. They really caught my eye that they seemed strange. So I started looking up on the internet, you know, what causes like very narrow fingernails? Because they're not supposed to be claws, at least they don't appear to be. And they, you know, what all I could find was a lack of iron and vitamin C in the diet could cause very narrow fingernails, apparently. So just a little science for everybody in the middle of our comic review. Anyway, our story is once again edited, written, and drawn by Jack Kirby and inked by Mike Royer. The story is called The Monster Fetish, and we open with the Tiger Squad and Commandy standing over the grave of the recently departed Flower. Commandy is actually down on his knees, and he's placing a bouquet of flowers while the Lions are giving a military salute, firing their rifles into the air. The grave says, "Here lies Flower, friend of man in an animal's world," which I'm not sure, because the animals in the animal's world don't consider themselves to be animals. They consider man to be the animal. So that's a little off in that way. But despite the show of respect by their leader, the Lion soldiers do not share their commander's feelings for what they view as a lowly creature, but they acquiesce to his directives to give Commandy some respect. As they speak, a shadowy figure tosses a grenade at them from behind some rocks. In a move worthy of Bugs Bunny, Commandy catches the grenade and throws it back from whence it came. The infidel was a guerrilla scout who is stunned by the explosion. The Lion commander, whose name is Sultan, if you'll recall, indicates that it's probably a ritual raiding group here to free Tiny. He provides Commandy with a gun and a horse so that he can conduct a recon. As he is off searching, Commandy falls victim to a gas shell and is taken captive by a group of gorillas. Much like Fay Wray, or Andaro, if you will, he is fastened to a pole where a ritual is being conducted and he is being presented to what they call the Great Fetish. The ritual takes place above a giant pit, and we see a shadow with the sound of a great roar, and then Tiny presents himself immediately, exhibiting frustration because he can't reach Commandy, who's calling for help. Commandy thinks to himself that Tiny must be over 100 feet tall and is kept in the canyon with the help of electrified walls. But if Jurassic Park has taught us anything, it's that life will find a way. And so the guerrilla party destroys the power station and releases Tiny, who grabs Commandy and makes quick work of the foolish gorillas. Tiny quickly takes a liking to Commandy, but is hit from behind by a Lion artillery with a sedative of some sort.
Oh, what a cute little pink bunny rabbit. Just what I always wanted, my own little bunny rabbit. I will name him George, and I will hug him and pet him and squeeze him.
I'm not a bunny rabbit.
And pat him and pat him and...
You're hurting me. Put me down, please.
And rub him and caress him and...
I ain't no bunny rabbit!
Not a bunny rabbit, George? Then how come you have long ears? How come?
Long ears? Oh, those aren't ears. Those are sleeves. So now put me down, please.
Oh, George, you were naughty to pretend you was a bunny rabbit. I will punish you good. Bad old George.
Commandy leaves with Sultan and is taken to a city where he marvels over the skyscrapers and factories. Sultan tells Commandy of the founding Lions, who broke out of Zoo, spelled Z-U-U, before the Great Disaster, and created a Declaration of Independence for the United States of Lions. But as they are talking, Tiny's giant paw crashes into the room and takes Commandy as he climbs the side of the skyscraper. Sultan orders his soldiers to pilot the experimental machines that they built from ancient photos and designs, and they take to the air in biplanes. As they strafe Tiny, he places Commandy down. The planes keep shooting, and Tiny falls to his apparent doom from the side of the building, much like a certain king that we are familiar with. And I don't know if we could say that it was beauty that killed the beast, but it was certainly his infatuation with Commandy. And then we're promised next month the return of Ben Boxer. So clearly, Kirby was going for a King Kong thing here. And I get the feeling that he probably came up with this idea early and said, how early in the series could I get away with doing this? So, he waited a few issues and was like, I just got to do this. And it is interesting to see a take on King Kong where he has the ability to speak. And he's clearly presented as kind of a simpleton. But, you know, he becomes very enamored with Commandy, who he thinks is a toy. And you know, there's no... Like, in King Kong, there's always that feeling of an underlying sexual attraction of Andarrow. Mm-hmm. So we don't have that. We just have a fascination with what he considers to be a toy for himself. You know, I guess he's looking at Commandy as kind of being a pet for him. And it's again, it's all done very quickly. You know, the whole King Kong thing, you know, I think we could have built up for this a little bit quicker. But overall, I find it enjoyable. I'm not finding as much satisfaction with Kirby's renditions of gorilla faces as I am with the other animals that he's done. And I'm wondering if that isn't kind of an effort by him to kind of distance what he's drawing from Planet of the Apes so that it doesn't look like he's stealing their stuff. I'm not sure, but his gorilla faces just don't look quite right to me. What'd you think?
The gorillas look like a warped Dark Side with beards.
Mm.
It's a Kirby creation.
Yeah, that's true.
That's the feel I'm getting off it. The lions look great. The gorillas, since their first appearance, they look odd. It's a very odd look to them. But I can
and
see...
Knowing the way comic books loved presenting giant monkeys and giant gorillas and giant apes, I'm surprised that they haven't refined that look a little better.
Well, it is his style, so... But they're so... far removed from the lions. See, the lions I really think look fantastic. I did find it amusing that Flower gets a four-gun salute.
Mm-hmm. But clearly not at the... not due to the desire of the saluters. What did they say? This is ridiculous. Imagine throwing a military funeral with all the trappings for a dead animal. On that page, which is page two, which is, you know, the two-page splash, I like the lion, the look of the lion who's furthest to the left. Like, very distinct from the other lions, as far as his look goes.
Yeah.
Kind of got a puffier face.
Yeah. Well, they all have... As weird as it is to say, they have an individual look to them, where it looks like the one closest to us on the left seems to be like an older lion. The next one, a younger one. There's something distinct about, I feel, you know, all the faces. It's not just a standard stamp out like the gorillas look.
Yeah, the gorillas, like, it's hard to tell one from the other. You could tell Tiny because his coloring is different and he's, you know, drawn at a different perspective. But otherwise, the gorilla faces all look very, very similar.
But, yeah, I could see the the lions being annoyed about this. Because, you know, Flower was a victim, that doesn't mean you get a military funeral. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I am not a veteran, as we've established in the
past.
Nor
am I.
But I think if somebody is a veteran, then they kind of feel like, well, I've earned this.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I could see where they could say, well, we're not doing this for somebody who hasn't earned it. And for them, it's probably a real insult to them to have what they consider to be an animal getting this... these high honors.
Right.
So I get that. It totally makes sense, and it's very good characterization by Kirby. I also like when they go into the city, you know, how the city is so much more elaborate and detailed than we've previously seen in the different societies. And Commandy seems equally impressed by this. And then Sultan's familiarity with their history as written by them, and you know, giving us basically their, you know, their background with the Chicago Zoo and the Philadelphia Zoo and the New York Zoo and the ZUU, and the Declaration of Independence and the flag of the United States of Lions, which has one star. And then there's a Medal of Honor that he shows him. So there's a lot of, you know, Kirby's establishing a lot of background for these, for this particular portion of civilization, which I like. And what I'm hoping to see as we keep reviewing these books is that those characterizations and those details of the different societies, you know, all get fleshed out, and you start really feeling like, okay, I understand where each of these factions come from, or, you know, what their perspective is.
Well, this seems like the most advanced society we've come across so far. Where you look at their city, and it's not just, you know, propped up ruins that are being used. Clearly, that's new construction. You know, it doesn't quite look like man's leftovers. And I'm curious about their history. You know, who are they declaring independence from? You know, it's like you get the vibe from the original Planet of the Apes movies, where you have conquest of the Planet of the Apes, where the apes rise up against man. Whereas here, I'm curious who they were fighting and who they declared their independence from.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only within Sultan's lifespan. So, I mean, what could you be looking at? 40 years? 60 years? I'm not sure exactly what the lifespan of a lion is, let alone an evolved lion.
Yeah, I mean, I got to think that a lion's lifespan currently, and I don't even know this, but I'm thinking in our world, a lion's lifespan is probably similar to dogs and cats, you know, maybe a little longer, maybe 20 years.
See, I would have guessed him. If only we had some device that we could look up.
Or if one of us was willing to do so.
Hang on, I'm looking here. Give me a second. Vamp around. Let's see. How long do lions live? Oh, you're right. 10 to 15 years. So they really are like a cat. Huh. I would have thought a bigger animal like that would have lasted longer.
Well, that was why I was kind of giving the benefit of the doubt to, you know, maybe it was 20 years or something like that, as opposed to 15. But I'm, you know, I can't say I'm surprised by that. I would imagine that the lifespan of a gorilla is probably closer to the lifespan of a human. And if only we had a device to look that up. But then that, you know, if you start factoring that in, and if you say that the evolving that they did to become what they have, if you say that hasn't changed their relative lifespans to each other, that might give the gorillas a great advantage over the lions. On the other hand, if the gorillas live longer, you would think that would give them more of an opportunity to be more learned.
Gorillas live 35 to 45 years in the wild. In captivity, they have lived for more than 50 years. Unless mm-hmm. they smoke, then it drops back down.
Well, how long can we expect to live? Because we're both in captivity.
I think we're on the way out.
It could be. You never know. But, you know, it's things like that. Like if Kirby wants to, that he can play with those factors. And I think it could make for some very interesting storylines. I don't know if he's going to do that. I think what he's going to do, or what I'm picturing here, is that each race of animal has now evolved to the point where they have a similar lifespan to humans.
Mm-hmm. That's what I would assume.
So, and you can get away with that as a trope, but I think it would be cool to have the different lifespans and have that be a factor in the political landscape that they have to, you know, work their way through.
Yeah. Tiny, I got the vibe of Lenny from Of Mice and Men.
Tell me about the rabbits, George.
Or the cartoon version. That's what I saw with.
Yeah, well, that's the Bugs Bunny version. That's actually, I've seen three different versions of that film. There's the Burgess Meredith Lon Chaney version, the original. And then there's John Malkovich and...
Gary Sinise,
correct. No, wait. Yes, John Malkovich and Gary Sinise. And then there's a third one that I'm losing... I can't remember now, a more recent one than that. And if only we had something we could look that up on. Why don't you vamp and I will look?
I have never seen any of the movies. I had to read the book in high school, and I found it to be the most depressing thing I ever read. So I have never visited any of the movies.
Okay, the Gary Sinise John Malkovich version is the one that I'm most familiar with, and I thought that was very good. Then we have, that is the 1992 version. Now, if I look back, there's also the Burgess Meredith version is the, where did I lose it to now, is the 1939 film, and then...
Who did Burgess Meredith play?
He was George.
He plays George.
Lon Chaney Jr. played Lenny.
Ah.
Why but am I not...
It's a very depressing story, folks.
Well, it's by the same laugh factory that brought us The Grapes of Wrath.
Well, I didn't read that. You know, as I get older, the less depressing stuff I want to watch.
I'm frequently of the same thought process. Here we go. There's a 2014 version. That's the one I couldn't find. And that stars... No, that was Broadway? Mm. It's James Franco as George, Chris O'Dowd as Lenny. That must be a film because it's in IMDb. It looks like it. You know what it looks like this is? It's a stage version that was filmed.
I remember when that was a regular thing.
You know what? I think very frequently, and I know we're on a real tangent here, but I think very frequently we'd be better off if they just filmed the stage versions of them actually performing it on stage rather than try and adapt certain things to film. And I'll give you the example of the Jersey Boys,
yes,
which I saw on Broadway and really loved. And the film version that Clint Eastwood made just doesn't have the same impact for me. And I think Clint Eastwood is a great director. But it still just did not have the same effect. Whereas I would have liked to have seen them actually just film them on stage performing Jersey Boys. And I think I would like it more.
I think you're right on that. But getting back to Commandy.
Oh, yeah, Commandy.
I get a kick out of the scene of them rushing to the fighter planes. It's like a really dramatic, neat scene.
You can almost hear the dramatic, patriotic music playing as they go to do it.
Right. You know what it reminds me of? The opening scene in Armageddon when the medias are coming in and this could be a surprise missile attack. You see him running for the fighter planes.
I like the fact that they say these biplanes aren't, you know, salvaged from the days of man, that they are created from drawings and, I guess, specs that they found, which also speaks to the intelligence of these lions, that they're able to take these specs and create planes that actually work from them.
And they're wearing almost astronaut-type uniforms.
Yeah.
So it's like
including the headgear.
Right, we bumped it up one. It's fantastic. It adds to what I said earlier, that this is an advanced society. That they're not just occupying, you know, old broken down stuff and making the best they can out of it. They're building up their own.
Yeah, I agree. They're taking the lessons of the past and building on them rather than just salvaging them or cannibalizing them.
If we visited them 30 years in the future, would they have jets?
I'm thinking yes.
Maybe even quicker, since they've already got specs.
Yeah. I think, you know, they needed to create something that would fly first, just to kind of get their feet wet. But once they got to that, with the ability that they have to build upon past discoveries, it shouldn't take them too long to turn planes into jets and jets into rockets.
Mm-hmm. Well, you figure the Wright brothers built planes similar to this in their garage. With stuff, you know, easily accessible. The lions need to improve their manufacturing capability to make
them. Tony Stark built these in a desert from scraps, in a cave from scraps.
Yeah, okay. That shows you how this is already more realistic.
So, any more thoughts on it?
Nah, just, you know what's funny? Is this was, what, 73. And it's before, it's 76, right?
The remake.
Which, yeah. I got to give him credit, because King Kong was in the 30s. If he had made this issue, written this right after the 76 movie, he'd be like, yeah, you saw the movie and decided to throw it in your book.
Well, King Kong was in the public consciousness. At this time too, because it was an annual Thanksgiving
right.
Showing, you know, even then. So I remember, you know, at that point I was watching King Kong at least once a year. You know, even without the advantage of streaming and you know, DVDs and Blu-rays and all of that, and we didn't have any of that, but I still saw it once a year anyway.
Right, because it was a schedule. That was Thanksgiving. That, Mighty Joe Young. I think there was another one too. I can't remember, but I thought
March of the Wooden Soldiers.
Yeah. Wizard of Oz in the evening.
Yeah, well, I remember how, like, TV Guide would say, you know, get ready to take the 23rd trip down the Yellow Brick Road. Or whatever year it was, you know, however many times they had shown it, because it was once a year, every year, and it was appointment viewing for kids.
Right, it gave you something to look forward to.
Yeah.
Don't you kind of miss that a little bit?
Well, you know, I've had this discussion before, and naturally my kids think, you know, I'm insane. You know, in my day, we didn't do this. But what it did, I'm not going to say it was better, but what it did was it made you appreciate it more when you got to see it. Because either you saw it when it's on or it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, you couldn't just say, I'll watch it whenever. And then, it loses its specialness by you can watch it whenever. You know, the fact that, you know, either you watch it or you're out of luck makes it special. So it wasn't better, but it felt better.
Yeah.
It felt more satisfying when you saw it.
That's, you tended to watch it like as a family.
Yeah, it became appointment viewing. Anyway, so this book is an example of why I don't like the 2/3, 1/3 cover. I feel like if Kirby had just been able to extend this to the top, you still would have had the same intrigue as to what Tiny is or who he is, because you still only would have really seen his arm. But I think it would have made for a more striking cover. I think the artwork on this is pretty compelling, though, so I don't want to penalize Kirby for the editorial decision to have the 2/3, 1/3 cover. So I'm going to say it's a solid B, and it would be a solid B even if it was extended. But it's, you know, it's very striking to me. I think it's really well done. The interior art, for the most part, I think we're seeing a little bit more of a return to what we had before, except for the gorilla faces. I just do not like the gorilla faces on this. And I dislike them enough to knock it from what would probably be a B plus just to a B. There's a couple of derp faces on Commandy again, too. The story, I got a kick out of the story. I like the world building that Kirby's doing. So I'm gonna give this story an A. And I'm going to say a B plus overall.
Yeah, I'm right up there with you. I agree with you that the two-thirds cover would have been better to be not two-thirds. But there's also a part of me that's starting to accept this is just the way, you know, it's like this is the format of these covers. So I'm really not going to take too much away from it. You know, when I looked at this quick, I almost thought, you know, I guess I didn't notice the biplanes right away, a quick look. And I almost thought he was at the Lincoln Memorial or something like that with the pillars. But it is a dynamic cover. I think it's subtle enough. Whereas if you had, you know, Commandy in his hand as he was hanging on the top of the building, it would have been too much of a ripple of, you know, the original design of King Kong.
So right.
I like the cover. I'm going to go with a solid B plus on the cover. The interior art, I'm with you. I like the way the lions look. I can't stand the gorillas. I like the lion's world. I'm giving the interior art a B. The story is an A plus. It's, you know, the last story, it was good, but, you know, I kind of felt it's almost like a little bit of a repeat. Whereas this laid new ground that I'm curious to see where it goes. I'm hoping he's going to give us more background on this. So based on that, my overall grade is a B plus.
All right. So that gets us through issue 7. So next time out on this particular retrospective, we're going to be hitting issues 8 and 9. I hope you guys are enjoying listening to our going through this world as much as we're enjoying traveling through it. And I got to say, I really am. Something I've wanted to do for years, so I'm looking forward. I'm just enjoying the heck out of doing this. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you, Dave, for indulging my Commandy need. And we'll see you next week.
Take care, everybody.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.